loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we're going to take a look at Turkey. The Turkish military is involved in operations against Kurds in the northern part of Iraq. We're going to take a look back to the 15 years of the Erdogan rule, the evolution or the devolution of Erdogan's reign of power. And then we continue our weekly series, Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of the courts, the prosecutors, police, and how justice is denied to so many people in this country. Every week, we take a look at some of the big stories in this so-called criminal justice system.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, in March, we told you about the case of Alejandra Pablos, a prominent local immigrant rights and reproductive health activist. Alejandra is a permanent resident of the United States, but when she went to an Immigration and Customs Enforcement office in Arizona for a routine check-in, she was arrested and held incommunicado. She's just been released, but is now facing deportation. Next, French President Emmanuel Macron said last night that he did not believe he changed President Trump's mind on the Iran nuclear deal and that he expects the U.S. to pull out of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action next month. He added that doing so would be bad for everyone, Iran, the European Union, and the United States. Then, teachers in Arizona walked out today in nearly 100 school districts across the state. The teachers are striking to reestablish education funding to the level where it was years ago. It has dropped 14% just since 2008 in Arizona, measured per student, and to stop passing tax cuts on the backs of public education. And then the CIA is actively tweeting its support for Deputy Director Gina Haspel's elevation to lead the agency. It routinely retweets articles supporting or endorsing Haspel while ignoring those that don't. This would seem to be an ethical violation. Isn't any federal agency supposed to be neutral on who may or may not lead it? And finally, President Trump told the hosts of Fox and Friends this morning that CIA Director Michael Pompeo was not supposed to meet with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un when he traveled to North Korea over the Easter weekend. But Kim walked into the room and the two spoke for more than an hour. Pompeo later said that Kim was very smart, a revelation for U.S. policymakers. But does the U.S. really know nothing about the North Korean leader? And in other headlines, in a 57-42 vote, the U.S. Senate today confirmed Mike Pompeo to be the new Secretary of State. The vote included five Democrats and Republican Senator Rand Paul, a longtime vocal opponent. Paul spoke with President Trump and Pompeo earlier this week and said afterward that he was assured that Pompeo truly understood that the Iraq War was unnecessary. That's something that Paul has frequently pressed him on. Human rights and anti-torture advocates are expressing outrage that Admiral Harry Harris has been nominated by the Trump administration to be the U.S. ambassador to South Korea. In 2006, Harris assumed command of the U.S. military base at Guantanamo Bay, where he presided over the prison notorious for torture, and guards under his command were accused of murdering inmates. Harris was initially slated to be ambassador to Australia before the administration decided instead to nominate him to the more high-profile post in South Korea. The Senate Judiciary Committee has voted in favor of legislation that would allow special counsel Robert Mueller to appeal in court in the event that he is fired by the Trump administration. The bill passed the committee by a vote of 14-7 and was authored by Democrats Chris Coons and Cory Booker and Republicans Tom Tillis and Lindsey Graham. However, it is considered unlikely that the legislation will be taken up by the whole Senate. A jury has convicted Bill Cosby, now 80 years old, of three counts of aggravated indecent assault, despite the defense painting his female accusers as con artists and liars. So far, this is the only criminal case to come out of accusations against Cosby from more than 60 women. Each count of aggravated indecent assault could put Cosby in prison for up to 10 years. Those are today's headlines. Next up is Turkey's quiet attack in Iraq. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
But first we turn to Turkey. Since the end of March, the Turkish military has quietly been building outposts inside Iraqi territory to attack the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK. The move is, of course, a violation of Iraqi sovereignty, and it points to Turkey's obsession with fighting the Kurds no matter where they are. We're joined from Washington, D.C. by Connie Zulam. He's the founder of the American Kurdish Information Network. And we're joined in studio by producer and Sputnik News analyst Walter Smolarek. Connie and Walter, welcome.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Connie, we want to talk, of course, about this new Turkish military offensive against Kurds in Iraq. It's not the first. But we want to also talk about the profound change in the evolution, or one might call it the devolution, of the Erdogan government. Erdogan became prime minister of Turkey in 2003, 15 years ago. Of course, that was the same year that the U.S. invaded Iraq. But let's start first with the newest news. What's going on in northern Iraq?
Turkey is invading Iraq, basically. Turkey has established 8 posts inside Iraq, a Kurdish region of Iraq. The Iraqi government is weak, has expressed, condemned the move. Turkey says, we have been there since Saddam Hussein gave us the green light. And Iraqi government, as well as the Kurdistan regional government, don't want the Turkish presence there, but Turkey is there anyway. And I think it has to do with the upcoming election in Turkey on June 24. In this country, when George Bush Sr. invaded or kicked out Saddam Hussein from Kuwait, his popularity went to 89%. And in Turkey, when Turkey invaded Afrin, Erdogan's popularity rose to 70%.
Afrin is Syria, of course.
That's right. And now he thinks if he attacks Kurds and says that we have established 8 different army posts, he's hoping that his popularity will rise and he will get the election, win the election on June 24, 2018.
Walter, his popularity, his poll numbers are high right now. Is Connie right?
Yeah, and I think he does stand a pretty good chance of securing a parliamentary majority in the elections. I mean, he has a new challenger, which is not even necessarily that different from his form of politics. It's called the Good Party. It's a split from a former Erdogan ally, the Nationalist Movement Party, which is the extreme right wing. Some might even call them like a fascist party in Turkish politics. Their leader was the previous interior minister at one point during Erdogan's government, who carried out, very aggressive policies towards the Kurdish people, who are primarily in the southeast of Turkey. Her party may do well. It's probably going to pass the 10% threshold. And so that's sort of like what's new in the Turkish opposition, but I doubt that it'll be enough to deny Erdogan's AKP a parliamentary majority.
And Connie, just in the last days, there have been more arrests of journalists, including one of the most prominent newspaper. Talk about that in Turkey.
Well, Turkey has replaced China, Egypt, Iran, in terms of the number one jailer of the journalists. Turkey now controls by some accounts, 80% of the media. The 20% is the alternative media. Erdogan is not leaving anything to chances. I mean, he wants to dominate the airwaves. He wants to intimidate the Kurds. The other parties, the alternative, like the opposition parties, the CHP, the HDP, the Good Party that is now against him, the MHP joined him. Together, they had the 61% of the population in the last election. But now the polls are saying that they might actually go below 50%. So if he doesn't win the first round, then there's a second round. And then the opposition will have to consolidate and come up with a candidate that is appealable, that is has the votes of the Kurds, the leftists, the liberals, because he's the center-right. And we'll see. I mean, the elections are going to be, if they're going to be fair, they're going to be tight. And if they're going to be unfair, then Erdogan might win. But he doesn't really have the mandate. There's tension in the country. There are 150,000 civil servants who have been given pink slips since the coup. And Turkey now, Erdogan is running it literally by decrees. The normal procedures have been suspended. It's the martial law, if you will. And he thinks the country should elect him. He has changed the laws as such that he could be in power until 2034. That would be 32 years in power. The longest serving American president, Roosevelt, served 16 years due to the Second World War because there was a, you know, you should run only for two terms. Erdogan would be running twice as much, twice as long. And he is absolutely no Roosevelt, if the audience wants to compare him with Roosevelt.
You know, I want to ask you, Connie, we seem to be seeing two different Erdogans. In the beginning of his tenure, even the minority communities in Turkey welcomed him. And it was because he seemed to be so liberal on so many of these issues. And then there was this gradual move to the right. He became more and more religious, at least outwardly. He became more and more conservative, and he became more and more willing to use force across borders and to go outside of Turkey. What do you think brought about that change? Why did he change so dramatically like that?
Well, he is on record. Has given an interview to a Milliyet newspaper, to a woman whose name is Nilgün, whose last name I'm forgetting, on July 14, 1996. He compared democracy to a streetcar. He said, you get to your destination and you get off. So his ulterior motives, if you will, were there. But the center-left government was so corrupt, was so inefficient, was so just didn't deliver on goods. And in 2001, there was an inflation in Turkey, and many of them basically imploded. And Erdogan, with 34%, dominated the parliament, dominated the Turkish politics, 34%. And initially, he did well. He allowed Kurdish. Kurdish radio. He allowed Kurds to have, Kurdish theater. He allowed Turkish leftists to have political space, if you will, in the government. And that lasted until 2007 and 2008. And then he lost enthusiasm. He basically turned right and he consolidated. And Gülen gave him, I would say, more firepower, if you will, more. He came up with these fictitious court cases against the generals, the Navy admirals. Many of them were brought down. And the relationship with Gülen lasted until 2013. And Gülen then exposed him for being corrupt, exposed him for getting bribes in the tune of, you know, millions of dollars, busting sanctions against Iran deliberately and getting rich for it, building mosques, building Imam Hatip high schools, which are predominantly Islamic curriculum. And so this is the Erdogan we have. And he hasn't been lax in terms of consolidating his gains. In 2015, when close to, was it 15 or 16, 1 million Syrian refugees sought refuge in Germany, Merkel came to Istanbul, met with him, promised him 7 billion euros to keep these refugees. And with that money, God knows what he's doing. Supposedly, he was supposed to, you know, help the refugees with this money. And it's not transparent. It's not accountable. He's now running the country with an iron fist. You tweet if he doesn't like your tweets. The police shows up at your door. I'll just give you an example. University of Boğaziçi, which is Bosphorus University, one of the most well-known universities in Turkey, after Afrin operation, after 58 days of resistance on the part of the Kurds, Afrin fell. A group of pro-government students distributed something called Turkish Delight. It's something sweet.
Lukumi, they call it in Greece.
Yeah. And some Kurdish students and some leftist Turkish students said, you know, this is obscene. War happened. People lost their homes. 500 people, civilians got killed. 15 Kurdish women after the city had fallen were taken away from their homes and nobody knows where they are. Kurds are afraid that they're used as sex slaves by these jihadi groups. And then there was an altercation of sort, nothing bloody. And then Erdogan heard about the altercation and on national television, he said, we know every single one of you who protested our victory and we will come after you and we will get you and put you in jail and you don't deserve to be in that university. Sure enough, the night after... Every single one of these students was identified. Every single one of these students was taken away by police, and now they're in jail. So it's a police state, a state as such that the government says, do this. I mean, Trump would love to have that, by the way, too. But this is what's going on in Turkey.
Yeah, I go to Greece with some regularity. And If there's one thing I've really never seen in Greece, it's a Turk. And this last time that I was in Greece last week, I saw hundreds of Turks. And it's because they're so afraid to stay in Turkey. They're so afraid that they're going to be next to be arrested and targeted.
I'm in touch with some of them, like this professor who's in Thessaloniki. She's because leftist and she's Kurdish and she's afraid of, you know, being thrown.
And that's the word that you keep hearing is fear. They're all afraid. There's a case right now where several Turkish fighter pilots fled to Greece on the evening of the coup because they were afraid of being implicated, even if they weren't a part of the coup attempt. And so the Greek Supreme Court ruled that they have a right to be political refugees in Greece, and they have the right to remain in the country. So what Erdogan did, because the Greeks won't turn these pilots over, is he had the military snatch two Greek soldiers from along the border, and now they're being held hostage.
That's right.
And he said that the only way that the Greeks can get their soldiers back is if they turn over these Turkish pilots.
Yeah, the hostage diplomacy has started. A lot of Germans were in prison in Turkey. Schroeder flew to Istanbul, met with Erdogan. One was released. Some others flew into Istanbul, met with Erdogan. Some others were released. Some Americans are. Father Brunson is in jail.
Right. And facing 35 years in prison.
Right. He's someone, you know, if you look at his history, who actually loves Turkey.
He loves Turkey, speaks Turkish.
Yeah.
He's an evangelical preacher.
Yeah.
And he's been charged with espionage.
Being a Gulenist.
Yes.
I mean, here's a Christian is being accused of being a, you know, a Muslim.
Well, let's talk, if we could, about, again, I want to stay with this theme of the evolution or devolution of Erdogan, the change in Erdogan's policies. Just yesterday, Cumhuriyet, or maybe it was the day before, the newspaper Cumhuriyet had 15 journalists who were taken off and arrested. We had a Cumhuriyet, a journalist who's been a guest on this show. She wasn't arrested. We saw her tweets. We had another guest on our show who's from the Turkish left, Kemal Okyan. He writes, he's the editor of Seoul newspaper. He was sentenced to many months in prison for, quote, insulting the president, meaning insulting Erdogan. And that's just in the domestic scale, the domestic arena. On the international arena, Connie, in the beginning, he said, and his administration said in 2003, zero problems with our neighbors. In other words, Turkey would be good neighbors with its neighbors. Since then, Turkey's been, you know, trying to, well, of course, overthrow the neighbor called Syria, but it's been involved in struggles and all kinds of conflicts with its neighbors. In other words, a complete change. At one time, a couple of years ago, it had awful relations with Russia, shot down a Russian airplane, and then Russia and Turkey made up, and now Turkey is buying S-400s from Russia or having S-400 and advanced missile system or missile defense system placed in Turkey. We have at one time, after his proclamation that he wanted to be a good neighbor with all his neighbors, it seemed like Erdogan had a fantasy of reestablishing the Ottoman Empire because, of course, northern Iraq was part of the Ottoman Empire. So was Syria. Very aggressive, changing position. Now, I want to get to the other big relationship, which is the U.S. relationship with Erdogan. When Obama, in the beginning, when in the first years of Obama administration, they had very good relations with Erdogan. There was a souring of that relationship. I think the last time Erdogan came during the Obama administration, there wasn't even a formal state dinner or state meeting. They kind of met on the side. Obama snubbed Erdogan. At the same time, in July 2016, was the attempted failed coup, but perhaps it was the Russians, not the Americans, who warned Erdogan about the coup, and the coup was narrowly defeated. It almost succeeded and probably would have cost Erdogan his life. But, you know, there were a lot of people who felt, well, if the U.S. didn't give, or the Obama administration or the Pentagon didn't give a green light to the coup, because the U.S. and Turkish military are very close because of NATO being partners, maybe they gave them a yellow light, proceed with caution. And if you succeed, cool. And if you don't succeed, that's your problem. It didn't succeed. then you had other people in, like in the Washington establishment, like Michael Flynn, who has now pled guilty. He registered belatedly as a foreign agent for Turkey, but he was involved perhaps in even possibly organizing the
kidnapping.
The kidnapping of Gulen, who Erdogan's former ally, who's now in exile, living in Pennsylvania, very old. I mean, it's a remarkable turn of events. Anyway, just walk us through some of that.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think the most galling is the, for example, Deputy Prime Minister of Turkey, just about maybe 2 weeks ago, was on the air saying, we have arrested 81 of our nationals in 18 countries and brought them over to Turkey. These are Turks who live in Pakistan, who live in Kosovo.
So they're kidnapping them.
Basically, yeah, going against the rule of law, grabbing these people, drugging them, and then finding a way to bring them to Turkey, accusing them of being, you know, treason, collaborating with Gulen. Whether they took, I mean, my hunch is these people are, Gulen is known for having schools and prep schools, universities all over the world. And some of these were teachers, were, let's say, in Kosovo or in Albania or in Serbia. And yet Turkish relations with these governments are such that they can, with impunity, go in and grab these people and then drug them and bring them to Turkey. I think the international community should, you know, say there's something called due process. You know, if somebody is guilty, if he is abroad, then if that country wants to extradite him, then you have to show that country, you know, like they wanted to have Gulen be extradited. Both Obama administration and Trump administration are saying, show us the, you know, show us the smoking gun. There isn't one. I don't mean to say that Gulen has nothing to do with the coup. That's not my position here. But this is what is going on.
Let me just ask what your opinion is. Was the coup a Gulenist coup?
Gulen definitely had people in the army, had people in the judiciary, had people, especially in the police force. And they played a role. But I don't think Turkey is so much Muslim that only they, like it was like one Muslim faction trying to overthrow another.
Well, right. And there's many secular forces inside of Turkey, including and maybe most notably the military.
That's right.
That would find common cause. My enemy's enemy is my friend. Gulen might not be their friend, but Erdogan might be their enemy.
And has the military been that emasculated? Have they been that stripped of power that they're no longer a threat to Erdogan?
You know, I happened to be in Cleveland, Ohio when the coup happened. I was trying to attend the Republican National Convention, meet some people there. And then I got some calls, people asking me, you know, who's behind this coup? My initial reaction was that it was the secular generals who just were fed up with Erdogan. This creeping Islamization of the country, you know, more mosques as opposed to more universities, more Imam Hatip liceses as opposed to more, you know, secular high schools. But I, the more I read about it, the more I think there are these because they were so prominent in the judiciary and so prominent in the police force. I think they played a role too. And they thought together with the Kemalists, they could, you know, end this Erdogan dictatorship. Now they're, you know, they're in jail. They are chased like, you know, as if they had rabbis. And I don't know. I mean, as far as asking Trump, I mean, American Brennan, CIA head Brennan, did America play a role? He actually didn't answer that question. Silence could mean consent, as some people say. I don't know.
I mean, that would be a pretty big deal, Walter. I mean, Turkey is the eastern flank of NATO. Now, again, we're not looking at any of the geostrategic issues through rose-colored glasses. If you put idealist rose-colored glasses on, you actually won't be able to see anything except your own fantasies, because all of these different entities are playing hardball. They each have permanent, as we say, permanent interests, but not necessarily permanent allies. Everyone is looking out for their own interests and have different agendas. But it would be a pretty profound thing if the United States said about the leader of the eastern flank of NATO, well, if the military carries out a coup d'etat and succeeds, so be it.
But before that, President Obama actually was on record, is on record for saying that, for example, Turkey is not doing enough to close its border with Syria. A lot of these cutthroats from Asia, from Europe, from other parts of the world.
For ISIS.
For ISIS types. We're using Turkey as a waylay station to cross it. So Erdogan had already expressed this. I mean, Obama had already expressed displeasure. And yet the coup came after. And then if it had succeeded, I don't think there would have been tears in this town.
2 minutes left. Walter, yeah, everything is complex. If people look at life as just this blueprinted conspiracy rather than understanding the complexity where agendas touch each other and then people have mutual interests that are temporary, they might not understand how this actually happens. Anyway, 90 seconds.
Yeah, and, you know, I think another piece of this is, you know, within Turkish society, even though, you know, in the electoral sphere, in the parliament, Erdogan has, you know, a very large majority among Turkish people who may, you know, not be affiliated with one political party or the other, or, you know, are political, but yet not engaged in like the formal electoral sphere. There is a lot of, I think there's a lot of dissatisfaction. So in 2013, there were massive demonstrations in Turkey. It started around Gezi Park, but it blossomed into this, you know, massive, massive movement, you know, hundreds of thousands of people in the streets, despite, you know, intense repression from the government for, you know, I believe it was several weeks, you know, keeping up these demonstrations. So, you know, that's the other thing that could happen here is that even if Erdogan is not defeated electorally, I think the people of Turkey who have, you know, a long tradition of resisting repressive governments could pull something off.
Yeah, that's I think that's a crucially important point. If we just look at the political elites in Turkey or in fact anywhere and try to understand politics and just drop the people out of the equation or the grassroots, then you might not see what's coming next.
I have heard one Turkish journalist whose name now escapes me say Erdogan almost got the Ceausescu model
treatment.
But he will get the Milosevic treatment eventually.
Well, the Milosevic treatment was the Milosevic treatment was the bombing of Serbia by NATO.
Well, no, that the fact
no,
that he was taken
up
to
the dock.
Okay, because it. But after the bombing by NATO. Anyway, that's another question. Anyway, we're completely out of time. We've been joined from Washington in our studio by Kani Zulam. He's the founder of the American Kurdish Information Network. And we're joined also in studio by producer and Sputnik News analyst Walter Smolarek. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we continue our weekly series, Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of our courts and prosecutors and how justice is denied to so many people in this country. We're joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we're joined from Nashville, Tennessee by Alex Friedman, the Associate Director of the Human Rights Defense Center and also Managing Editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you for having us.
Always good to talk to you. So we've got a lot of stories this week. You know, it just seems like it's a never-ending parade of egregious constitutional violations of people's civil rights and civil liberties. I want to start first, Kevin, with you. There was a report this week that a man was shackled for days in a prisoner transport van. He filed a suit. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, yeah, so the story, his name's Edward Kavari. This happened back in 2016. And I thought I was not familiar with this company. I didn't know if Shadowproof had covered prisoner transportation services. They're based in Nashville. But the way in which this person was treated and the way in which these inmates were treated as alleged in this lawsuit is incredible. I mean, the fact that for 18 days, they basically only get like 1 to 2 nights where they actually get to sleep. Other than that, they're shackled in the back of this transport that's going cross country. I mean, they're going from they're headed to Texas, where he's alleged to have committed a crime, from Virginia. So from Virginia to Texas, and then there's several detainees, and they're picking them up without rest or care. The people who are in this vehicle are not giving a chance to. They have no opportunity to go to the bathroom. So there's defecation and urinating going on inside the vehicle with people, according to Edward, just sitting in their own filth, basically. And human waste. There's really no ventilation, no functioning air conditioning. So you're inhaling and breathing in this mess. And I just found this to be really incredible. And I not know much about this private company, but the way that this is described, it just, you know, there's sleep deprivation going on. It's like basically like our own interstate rendition company going on.
Yeah, I actually know a little bit about sleep deprivation just because it was such an important part of the CIA's torture program. The American Psychological Institute has told us in press releases and studies that they have carried out that people begin to lose their minds at day 7 with no sleep. They begin to die at day 9 with no sleep. And here you have what really amounts to a cross-country sleep deprivation trip that these prisoners just have to accept. They're, as Kevin said, they're sitting in their own filth. They have no one to represent them, no one to look out for them. And in fact, when you are in what's called transportation status, at least in the federal system, you do not have access to a telephone, to email, or even to a pen and paper. No one in America outside the prison system knows where you are. There's no one to represent you. Go ahead, Alex. Tell us about your own experiences on this thing.
Well, fortunately, I did not have any personal experiences in being transported by private companies to facilities in other states. But we're very familiar with this industry. So back in 2006, Prison Legal News ran what was at the time the definitive article on the private prison transportation industry. And not a lot has changed since then. The exact same companies are still involved, the same business model, the same practices, and so on. So this lawsuit, which was filed by attorney Jeffrey Fogel out of Virginia as local counsel, is unfortunately what it describes is very typical. There is absolutely nothing unusual about what they describe. So usually you have people that are picked up on typically fairly minor charges, and these are allegations. In other words, most of the time these people being transported to other states, they're being transported to go to trial or to face charges. That is, they have not yet been convicted. Now, there are exceptions, of course, but this was not one of them. So the plaintiff in this case, Mr. Kavari, was transported to face charges, and then after he got there, after this 18-day harrowing trip, charges were later dismissed.
Oh, good heavens.
And people that are charged and transported, you would think, oh, well, these must be very serious charges, you know. But like most people that are charged in the United States, the vast majority of charges are nonviolent or drug-related, or in some cases, simply things like failure to pay child support, which is incredibly frequent. And so a failure to pay child support, it means a warrant is issued for your arrest, say, in California. And the charges are back in Florida where you used to live. And so one of these transport companies then transports you cross country, which, you know, can take weeks to get there under these terrible conditions. And everything that's described, lack of bathroom breaks, a lack of decent food, inability to contact people. In this case, it was alleged lack of medical care, which also is incredibly common. So Mr. Kavari had medical conditions, and they did not provide him with his prescription medications for hypertension, which caused his blood pressure to spike dangerously high, and he was hospitalized after he arrived at his location where they're transporting him. So these companies that do this, and there's a number of them, PTS, which is based in Nashville, where my office is one of the largest, if not the largest, after a recent merger with another private transport company. They're in business to make money. They're not in business to ensure prisoner safety or the public safety. There have been a lengthy, lengthy record of abuses by this industry, including accidents, which, of course, involve other vehicles and escapes from private transport vehicles, deaths in private transport vehicles. And this industry is almost entirely unregulated. Ironically, there are more regulations for transporting livestock between states than there are for transporting people between states. And there's only one law on the book on the federal level that governs this industry. It's Jenna's Law. And that law has been enforced exactly once since it was enacted over a decade ago. And it was enforced in one case involving an escape. But the law doesn't govern things like humane treatment of prisoners or sleep, as you mentioned, which is incredibly important, or, you know, decent food or decent medical care or the ability to communicate with families. None of that. The law strictly involves security-related issues, such as making sure prisoners have identifiable garb or that local authorities are notified quickly in case of an escape, those type of things. So there are some regulations to ensure that private transport drivers can only drive a certain amount of time, just like, you know, 18-wheelers, how tractor-trailer drivers can only, you know, legally travel a certain amount of time, then they have to take a break. But as this case states, the way the companies kind of get around that is they'll have two drivers. They'll have, you know, two staff members in the van. When one goes on break, the other one immediately takes over. So the vehicle never stops, right? The vehicle just keeps going all the time.
Yeah, it's amazing. That's the voice of Alex Friedman. He's talking to us from Nashville, Tennessee. Alex is sitting in for Paul Wright for this weekly segment of Criminal Injustice. Alex is the founder and associate director of the Human Rights Defense Center. He's also the managing editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. We're also joined from Chicago by Kevin Gostella. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. John and Alex and Kevin, we're talking about the treatment, the mistreatment, the abuse, or I would say, as John, as you were alluding to, the torture of prisoners, including those, not that torture would be legal under any circumstances, including those who haven't been, quote, found guilty. They're just being punished. They're being tortured. When you look at legal definitions of torture, and I think what we're talking about here when you're in transportation status is just that, or for many people, the definition includes three cumulative elements. One, the intentional infliction of severe mental or physical suffering. Two, by a public official who is directly or indirectly involved. And three, for a specific purpose. I'm not sure what the specific purpose is in these cases, but it is the intentional infliction of mental and physical pain by public officials. Let's just call it by its right name.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is not the criminal justice system. This is a form of torture, and torture is not legal. Torture is illegal according to all international law. And yet, I think, except for the organizations like Prison Legal News or Shadowproof or a few others doing this, you don't hear anything about this in the mainstream media.
Now, I can't tell you how many times I have sat down to read Prison Legal News magazine or Criminal Legal News magazine more recently on a plane, in the car, whatever, and I am shocked at what I'm reading. And it's because you just don't see these kinds of articles, this kind of reporting in the mainstream media. And these are issues, Brian, that cut directly to the constitutional rights of Americans. And either they don't know about them or they don't care about them. And certainly the large publications across this country don't seem to care.
Kevin Gostella, why don't they care?
That's a good question. I think that, I know that one of the things you flagged that we might be getting into was the just sheer scale of the prison industrial complex, you know, over 3,000 companies being involved. So maybe they don't care because money talks and someone's paying them not to care about the way in which people are being mistreated. You also have a culture where people who are convicted automatically are treated as the worst of the worst of the worst, and they're not to be given any human rights behind bars, and even sometimes going so far as to have really crude and lewd prison rape jokes about them and what they deserve for what they did, and they should get that behind bars is the way in which some people talk, even people who are elected officials talk in this degrading manner. And so I think that has something to do with it. But I just want to say that I hope that I continue to be shocked by reading these stories, like the one we talked about with the prison transport, because I don't want to open a story like that and think that, even though I know that's typical conduct of our country and under the prison industrial complex, that's what happens to people. I don't want to ever go, oh, that's just another day in the life of an inmate sleeping in human filth. I mean, when I read that, I definitely was shocked and wanted to share it around with people.
Well, let's, John, get into one of the stories that Kevin alluded to. 3,100 companies that are invested in mass criminalization.
Imagine.
Alex Friedman, we know war is good for business, at least those who produce arms and armaments and the supplies. It's very good business. Whenever there's a cruise missile attack, say, on Syria, Raytheon stocks go up because they're going to have to replace those 100 cruise missiles with others. But the prison industrial complex, like the military industrial complex, it incentivizes locking people up, depriving them of their freedom, their liberty. I mean, you might say it's protecting society. You might say it's, you know, punishing wrongdoers. You might say whatever. But when you look at 3,100 profit-making companies that are invested in mass criminalization, that speaks volumes about what's really perhaps the ABCs of America's criminal justice system.
Well, I have to admit, after doing this kind of work for over two decades, you do get a little jaded. But first, I want to mention that the 3,100 companies, involve for-profit companies involved in the criminal justice system. This is from a recent report issued by the Urban Justice Center this month, and it lays out kind of a directory of a vast number of different companies that are involved in pretty much every aspect of criminal justice, everything from running prisons to providing equipment and electronic devices that are used in prisons and jails, providing food and commissary, medical care, mental health care, pharmacy services, phone services, money transfer services, pretty much every conceivable aspect of our corrections and criminal justice system has been privatized, or rather monetized. And this is a vast undercount. So the report makes clear they don't include everybody. It's only certain companies that have above a certain dollar amount in revenue, and also they don't include the bail bond industry. And pretty much every city in the United States has a bail bond company running a service to, you know, get people out of jail for a fee. So the 3,100 is just a scratching the surface, really. There's a lot more to it than that. But this is America. This is what we do. The one thing that we're really known for, that we're really good at, is monetizing things and making money from them, generating profit. And unfortunately, our criminal justice system is no exception. You would think there's some things that we only want the government doing. You know, if I floated the idea that maybe we should have a private police force, you know, run by private companies rather than sworn public police officers, and they were paid, you know, according by arrest. So the more arrests they make, the more money they make. Well, most people would say, well, that's ridiculous. I mean, these companies, you know, would have a financial incentive to arrest everybody for everything, you know, jaywalking, spitting on the sidewalk, loitering, everything. I mean, it's just natural that companies are going to maximize their revenue. But that, in effect, is what we already have in the United States. We have companies that profit from the more people that are locked up, the more services they can provide, running prisons, running jails, providing these ancillary services like food and medical care. They all profit from people who are enmeshed in the criminal justice system. And for those of us who have worked within this system, injecting a profit motive is a really bad idea. Because then things like protecting the public, ensuring that prisoners, for example, receive services that they need so they can rehabilitate themselves, so they can get out and not commit more crimes, addressing substance abuse, addressing mental health issues, all really important stuff in our criminal justice system, all that is secondary. When you inject the profit motive into any industry, then the main objective, the main goal becomes making money. And I would submit that's not a goal we need in our criminal justice system.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. When there's a profit motive, there's, of course, an incentive to keep more and more people in prison because that's how these companies make their money. They're not going to make any money if they're catering to empty prisons. And so it becomes a vicious cycle. You know, one of the things, too, about this segment that we do every week is we try really hard to talk about some of the bigger, the broader issues that are relative to our justice system. But there are some anecdotal stories that I think are so important that we just have to talk about them. We have to spread the word. I'm talking right now about a case in Florida, in Largo, Florida. There was an awful incident where Largo police shot and killed a black man. Now, they had pulled him over because he had tinted windows on his car, which apparently is some kind of big crime. You see this all the time, that tinted windows are unacceptable. So they pulled him over. One of the police officers that pulled him over said he thought he smelled marijuana. The driver tried to run away, and he was shot and killed. Now, that's a tragedy. That's an awful, terrible tragedy. It happens all the time in America where a white cop kills a black man who's trying to run away and gets away with it. But that's not the end of this tragedy. What happened next is truly sickening, and I want you to talk about it, Kevin. What did the police then go and do after the man was dead?
They went there and attempted to use his fingerprint to unlock his iPhone.
Yeah, they went to the funeral home. They pulled his cold body out of the refrigerator and tried to use his finger to open his cell phone
to prove that he was responsible for his own death.
Right,
their murder of him.
Stunning. But that's what we're coming to in this country. And interestingly enough, the police said that they didn't think they needed a warrant because after death, you have no vested interest to protect.
Yeah, I'm looking at the picture. Florida police shoot and kill black man, then go to funeral home and attempt to unlock his phone using his fingerprint. This is from The Root. And it's a picture of his mom, Martha Hicks, Linus Phillips' mother, crying as she talks about what happened, where they actually came without, obviously, the permission of the family and go into the morgue and pull the guy's body out and try to get the fingerprint, only not to solve a crime, just to demonize him so that they can justify having murdered him because he had tinted windows.
And shame on the funeral home for even acceding to something like this. There has to be a lawsuit there.
Yeah. Go ahead, Kevin.
I question the idea that you wouldn't need a warrant simply because anything from you that you leave behind becomes part of your estate. And I would believe that the family had ownership of all of this property. They certainly control that iPhone now and should be able to say, please get a warrant, officer, if you want to go through the data on it. But aside from that, I just know from experience following these sort of cases, I think what people need to realize is that not only is there this code of silence that we've talked about, not only do you have officers getting away with murder, not only do you have officers covering up the murder in ways that are egregious and offensive to families, but you have going above and beyond that, where in moments when families are grieving after this, they do not allow them to have their moment to hold a funeral or to grieve in the way they may want to. If they do public demonstrations as part of the grieving process, they can be very brutal in the way that they manhandle and try to shut down these demonstrations. We've seen with the rise of Black Lives Matter that people will go to the sites of these incidents and they will turn them into memorial sites and they'll do next to nothing to prevent other people from those communities from burning down. We know in Ferguson, Missouri, around the death of Mike Brown after Officer Darren Wilson shot him, that there were stuffed animals and other things left there in his honor, and people would set fire to this memorial, and police would do nothing to protect those items from being burned down. You also have people, you know, you have police confiscating memorial sites, which usually does not happen when somebody gets into a car accident and they go leave flowers where the car accident takes place. Those are usually left. People don't mess with them. But in this case, police are very, very regularly will mistreat the families and people who are grieving after these incidents.
Yeah, it's a long line of incidents like this and stories just all across the country. They are well reported for the most part, but there just doesn't seem to be any kind of a national will to stand up to the police.
Let's just talk about why that might be.
Yeah.
Because if, you know, you sent a few police to life for life in prison, if you sent, you know, let's say you put some cops on death row, for instance, that would be a signal to other police that, you know, there could be actual consequences. There must be, and I believe there is, a reason why this kind of lawlessness on the part of law enforcement is tolerated by the real powers that be. And when we talk about the powers that be, when they want to go after something and make something happen, they certainly can. There's unlimited resources actually within the state. Why is it that the powers that be, the establishment, for lack of a better word, don't want to police the police? Why do they let this happen? There must be a reason. And I think the reason is it's a kind of social control issue over especially poor working class urban communities, people of color, and the idea that the police are a power unto themselves and nobody can really, you know, you're never going to really get justice.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of a message that the powers that be, that the establishment want those communities, because let's face it, in the last 70 years in America, these are the exact places where real social change has come from, real social movements that have demanded changes, sources of radicalism in the country. I think it's social control. Anyway, what, Alex, what's your take?
I think that has merit, but I think it might be a slightly simpler idea also. So I think most people realize that wealth does not equate to morality. So some of the wealthiest people in the U.S. and, well, everywhere, commit crimes just like poor people do. They just commit different crimes. So the question is, so why don't we police affluent, you know, communities as much as we police poor communities? And part of this, I think, has to do with resources and how easier it is to convict and arrest and convict and imprison people from poor communities who don't have a lot of money to hire, you know, legal representation and so on. So when you go after poor people, they have very few options. They can't hire attorneys. They have to go to an overburdened public defender's office where they, basically they're just plea bargain mills where they just plea bargain as many people as possible. This is why around 95% of criminal cases in the United States are resolved by plea bargains, not by going to trial. Trials are a dying animal. They're an endangered species. And so on. So they don't have the resources. They're forced into these plea bargains and they get convictions and go to jail, go to prison. If you were trying to police the police, well, police officers are represented by unions, and unions are fairly powerful and they have money and they hire attorneys. And there's a number of laws that are already on the books in a lot of jurisdictions in the United States called the Policeman's Bill of Rights or something similar, where they have protections that are kind of unheard of outside of police departments. Things like, oh, well, if police officers are accused of a crime or misconduct, they don't have to talk to investigators for 3 days. They only have to talk with them when there's a union rep present, and so on. So there's this vast disparity in resources and the ability to effectively police the police. And for the same reason, when you go after people who are wealthy and affluent, you end up with situations like the Dream Team and the O.J. Simpson trial, or just more recently in the Bill Cosby trial, where Bill Cosby is represented by a team of incredibly powerful and effective attorneys because he has the money to hire them. When you go after people with money, then they have the ability to defend themselves and to, in some cases, either beat the charges, make sure the charges are not filed in the first place, or if they are eventually sentenced, they can appeal it, often successfully, and so on. So the amount of resources you have to put into those cases are vastly more than the just kind of shooting in the barrel when you are charged and arrest poor people. I did want to say one thing about this particular case where they stopped this gentleman for, you know, having tinted windows. I've been stopped for having tinted windows by the police. And these are simply pretextual stops. These are a means for the police to get their foot in the door. So, oh, we think that you have darker windows than you were supposed to have, so we're going to pull you over, and then we're going to check for warrants, or we're going to run your plates, and we're going to see what we can find on you. And this whole notion of, oh, well, your windows might be too dark, well, that's a very subjective thing. There are devices that actually will measure and the tint on a window that measures the light going through to see if it's legal or not. the vast majority of police officers don't have those. And when I asked, the officer that pulled me over didn't have one. So how are you going to tell if a window is actually too dark if you don't have the device to tell you it's too dark? These are very subjective, and they're pretext to do these traffic stops to just see what else they can dig up, see if you're willing to let them search your vehicle and so on. So this is kind of the situation we have. We have policing primarily of the poor, mainly because they're really easy targets.
We have 1 minute left, John. Kevin, this is an important topic. I will come back to it week after week, actually. But let's have you take us out on the same theme, if you would.
Yeah, I think that what people really need to recognize is that these people are given no chance to grieve, and that basically the whole idea that they would go into a funeral and take somebody's fingerprint just shows you that they don't believe that people, black bodies, brown bodies, whomever's bodies that have been shot and killed by an officer need to be respected. They're not sacred. And so they see these as part of criminal cases. They see people as criminals. And so when you're dead, there's no thought that, okay, we're responsible. We are responsible for doing that. We're in trouble. No, it's that we can trample all over it. This is a crime scene, and we can do whatever we want to continue our investigation.
Yeah, it's true, and it's ugly, and it's going to keep happening time after time after time. We'll end it there. We were joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we were joined from Nashville, Tennessee by Alex Friedman, the Associate Director of the Human Rights Defense Center. He is also the Managing Editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.